Good evening, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to Illinois Public Media's Community Cinema Screening. My name is Henry Radcliffe. This is the premiere of WILL's second season of the Community Cinema Screening and Discussion. I'm the Community Engagement Producer and Community Cinema Series Manager at Illinois Public Media, WILL Radio, TV, and online. All across the country, people in over 100 communities are coming together to watch and discuss tonight's film, Pray the Devil Back to Hell. Public television is known for our high-quality independent documentaries, and tonight we hope to continue to earn a reputation for bringing cinema out to the community to watch and enjoy, but also engage in meaningful discussion about local connections to the issues in the film. In order to do that tonight, we have two ladies to help with tonight's discussion, Susan Ogwal, case manager at the Champaign Consortium, and Irene Aninye, PhD candidate at the University of Illinois. And of course, we're grateful to our local partner, the Champaign Public Library, who provides us with this auditorium for our screening, and our national partner, the Independent Television Service, who brings the Community Cinema Series to all of us public television stations and provides us with quality independent documentaries to air every week on WILL-TV and the public broadcasting system. We were supposed to have a translator for closed captioning or for audience members who would need that service. Are there any members who might need that service? And I don't think the order got to the person that was supposed to schedule us, and I apologize for anyone who would need that service. The film is closed captioned, and the discussion will be recorded by Mike Pritchard from Illinois Public Media. And I thank you all for coming, and we're going to start the film now. Right after I started the film, our sign language translator, Stacey Leverage, arrived, and she will be signing this part of our discussion. And next to me is Irene Aninye, and on the end is Susan Ogwal. Actually, first, I'd like to ask my panel members to, what did you think of the film?
Well, I think the biggest word that can describe this film was powerful and very moving. That's how I would describe the film.
The film, to me, was very engaging. A story where you see the power of speaking up, that one woman being able to mobilize other women and coming on one accord regardless of background. And so for me, that it really kind of ignited something, even to see what can I do in my local community, what needs my attention. So.
And I personally was moved by the way the women took charge of the situation that they were in, even though they were pretty reduced to almost like the lowest denominator in their society. But they decided to step up and get everyone else's attention, and specifically get the attention of the men who were causing all of the trouble, if you will. And just by the women uniting together as women, they were able to turn that situation around. The other thing that I was kind of surprised about is, as I've watched this, I was trying to think, what was I doing during this time frame? And I don't remember this being in the news a lot. And I think that's one of the aspects that I take from it. These things happen, and they are totally destroying this country, and we're just now finding out about this, 8, 9 years later. And for me, the first time I actually found out about this was watching this film. Now, we're not going to dominate this discussion. I know there are many people in the audience that have things to say about what we just saw. So please, we have a microphone out here, and people in the audience, please tell us what you thought about that and why it moved you. Or if there is anyone here that might like to share some insight into that situation.
Hi, my name is Kathy Perkins. I want to thank you for presenting this film. I teach theater. Well, I recently semi-retired at U of I. I teach theater, and I teach a course on African women in theater, and I use this film as a way to educate women about the history of women in Africa through theater.
Could you stand up?
Oh, okay. And it's a very powerful film. Right now, I highly recommend as another film called Iron Lady, which looks at President Sirleaf, you know, her first year in office. And right now she has a wonderful autobiography out called This Child Will Be Great. And it talks about the history of Liberia and the war. And I say all this to say the reason why a lot of people didn't know what was going on is because of the U.S. ties to Liberia. They didn't want us to know what was going on. Because if you know where Liberia is on the west coast of Africa, it's a very strategic place for the U.S. And if you know anything about the history of Liberia, it was founded by the U.S. as a colony. They sent, you know, African Americans back there in the 1800s or something like that. So they didn't want you to know. This was during the Reagan era, the Bush era. They wanted you to think that things were all well there. So that's why a lot of people didn't hear about what was going on. And Firestone, we all know what Firestone is. They own basically half the country. At least they did. I mean, things have changed a lot under Johnson. It's just amazing what this woman has done within the past couple of years. Anyway, I just wanted to say that.
What's happening now? She's got the country out
of here. Oh, go ahead.
You could go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I'm not a political
Someone
scientist.
Asked, what's happening now?
Is there someone here in African studies? I know she's really gotten the country out of debt. She used to work for international banks, for the IMF, so she had friends. And she's really gotten Firestone to pay people decent wages because, you know, during Taylor's reign, Firestone was just not paying people anything. And they lived in substandard housing. But she's changed a lot of that. And rape is a serious crime in Liberia. You just can't get away with it. So she's done a lot, and she's put a lot of women in power, you know, good women, people who know what they're doing. But anyway, I'm in the midst of reading her autobiography, which is amazing. And like I say, there's a film about her first year in office called Iron Lady. And I always show this film first, and then I show Iron Lady, so students can understand the progression of what was going on.
Could you mention the title of that book, her autobiography?
It's called This Child Will Be Great. It was something Sirleaf's was told as a child, told her mother, it's like, oh, this woman's going to be great. And it just follows her life, you know.
And the library has a copy.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not as particularly versed with Liberia, but I know there have been a number of African nations that have had similar experiences with their civil war, and it takes some time to be able to rebuild the country, even when we had our own civil war here in the United States. However, you're definitely seeing that upward movement and kind of building things back up, as far as there's a lot of religious movements that are now going, and people are kind of connecting in that form to be able to rebuild their homes and get encouragement and, you know, reintegrate back into society.
And I would even say that just a film like this would hopefully motivate someone here to really start paying attention to the happenings beyond the Champaign-Urbana community. I think oftentimes we get so comfortable in our own little world or our own little sphere of influence, and we don't necessarily pay attention unless it affects us. So maybe when I think about the recent flooding and the heavy hurricanes and rains and all these things that have happened, a lot of us don't pay attention to it unless it's connected to someone we know or it's personally connected to our family members. But even beyond that scope, there are other greater things or similar great things that are affecting nations and whole people groups that are going to affect us, whether it's our generation now or the generations to come. And so I think that even at this moment, it would be an urgency, really a call for everyone here to pay more attention to the news and to ask the questions that aren't being asked, you know, and not be afraid to raise those issues up before people and just really dialogue and talk about those things so that you can even mobilize change to occur, even if we're far across the seas, so...
Excuse me. She's going to bring you a microphone because we're recording this discussion, so we would like all of it to be recorded. Thank you.
My husband and I, for years, the only magazine we quarrel about when it comes every week is The Economist, which is a British magazine. It comes out every week, and every week it covers the whole world, not every country every week. Most American media only tell you about a country when there's something awful happening there. Mm-hmm. But every week The Economist will go over every continent, some countries of it. And they'll tell you if the country's getting better, if the country's getting worse, what's happening in the economy. But not just the economy, everything, the politics. So if you read that, and I'm sure the library subscribes to it, you get a much better idea of how the whole world is going. Thank you.
I have something to say.
Yeah.
Part of the problem the United States has is that it's a very insular nation. I think I can be heard because I'm popular.
Right. I know, but we can't record you unless you're talking to the microphone.
Well, what I was saying is that the United States is a very insular country, despite its size and all the things that are said about the greatness of this country, which is great in many ways. This is true. But the United States is wrapped up in football, basketball, and fun, and about MTV and all these things, and it doesn't really give a hoot about what's happening. In Latin America, it's not very far from here, you know? I mean... it's just the fact that the United States is very selfish. You know, I taught a class at Parkland College, and it was called Latin American Culture. And I switched the class around to fit what I wanted to do with it instead of following the prescribed, you know, teach this book and use this book and all that stuff. So I turned it around and I said, I need to change this around and give it the focus of how the United States has influenced Latin America and its culture, you know. And I remember very vividly that there was a meeting between the foreign minister of Chile, Kissinger, and Nixon, and the foreign minister of Chile said, the problem with the United States is that you don't pay attention to anybody else. And then Kissinger stepped in and he said, excuse me, sir, but the axis of power goes from New York, Washington, London, Tokyo, Paris, and Frankfurt. And whatever else happens in the world is of no importance to us. And that's what he said. And based on that, this is the mentality of the leaders of this country. Even today, even though Mr. Obama is the president of the United States, he's a creation of the United States, you know? And I'm not saying that this is a nasty nation, but it needs to learn to live with the world. Just the fact that everywhere in the world, everybody uses the metric system, and this is the only country that's isolated from the world. That's crazy, you know? It's actually dumb, you know? And it's little things like that tell you what people really have up here about the world.
Hi. I know that Charles Taylor is at The Hague right now being tried for war crimes. That was in the news today. And I wonder, Mr. Radcliffe, could you tell us who our panelists are, where they come from, and how they came to be on this panel? We have their names, but I'm wondering who they are.
Okay.
Well, my name is Irene Ninge, and I am a doctoral candidate at the University of Illinois. I'm actually in the School of Molecular and Cellular Biology, but my background is Nigerian. And so, actually, very similarly, my family, my parents, came to this country during the Nigerian Civil War. And having to escape some of those crimes, particularly even actually my father at the time needed to flee the country to escape being in concentration camps and being taken off into prisons unnecessarily. So that's a little bit about my background. And
hello again, everyone. Again, my name is Susan Ogwal, or Ogwal, and I do work for the Champaign Consortium here, and specifically as a case manager and a counselor there. My background also, I studied here at the University of Illinois with my bachelor's in sociology, and I'm currently involved in ministry as well as I am now a master's of arts student with Garrett Theological Seminary in Chicago in pastoral care and counseling as well. My background in terms of my family is that we are also products of war. My family specifically, and including myself, I can remember fleeing war on foot. I can remember civil unrest in our country, which is Uganda. And I'm sure you all have heard some of the things that have been going on recently with some of the youth in Uganda as well. So I can certainly testify to the aftermath of what war can do for you, being a child who's witnessed and seen so much in such a short period of time, but also now, in a sense, being given a second chance at life and to really grasp that. So my heart certainly goes towards those victims of war as well. So.
And my recently hired new associate producer, Carletta Donaldson, in the back, was responsible for putting this panel together. Who has the microphone?
Well, thank you for presenting this film. And I have to tell you, this film was absolutely terrifying from just watching it. So I can't imagine what it must be like to be in that situation. And like Henry, what kept roaming through my mind is, what would I do if I were there? Mm-hmm. And I'm not so hopeful about myself. So the courage of these women is just astounding. But I do have a question. I bet somebody here can answer it. In these countries that are very poor, how is it that they can be so well equipped with weapons and they can't get fed? So how does that happen?
A lot of...
I mean, weapons don't grow like corn. You throw, mm-hmm. So how does that happen?
The country has resources. The distribution of wealth is skewed. So that's typically what happens. The government is extremely wealthy, or those that hold power, those that are in the banking systems, and then the average person is living very impoverished. So if you're connected to those particular individuals, you have access to those guns, you have access to those weapons and materials, and then they continue to steal from the average citizen and the average person. So when you say that they're impoverished, it's... the distribution of wealth is different than it would be looked at in another country.
And I would even say that it's a cycle of dysfunctionalism. Yeah. Because if you have been the victim of so much dysfunction, even within your own families, unless someone presents something different to you, you're going to stay in that cycle, and it's going to remain normal to you. So for those children who've seen the cycle of violence and rape and running and having to go outside for food or what have you, that's all they know. That's all they knew. And so to continue in that for them is normal versus someone who may come outside or someone has the concept, this is not right. You know, just like the women stood up and raised up a standard and said, something has to change. There has to be an internal mechanism that says this is not right, you know, and change must occur. So I concur with that. Certainly with a lot of other nations outside of the U.S., the distribution of wealth is completely different and certainly skewed. I can only imagine in the U.S. here, if we elect, you know, whatever president that we elect, and he holds certain, I guess, key values or key components to his particular campaign, then you're going to see that those particular values continuously being fed and invested in and so forth, in the same way with some of those African nations as well. So I hope that helps.
And I just wanted to add briefly that if you notice, they made the comment that the warlords were living well during the peace talks. So they weren't actually flourishing at home, but they were kind of they were doing it to aspire to get power. And so that was kind of their drive. If I do this and I stick through, then I can get a position. I can now be, you know, get a job. I can get a role that will now allow me to get wealth. And so they actually weren't living well, but they were stealing because they didn't have in the first place. So,
if you remember, early in the film, they had pictures of diamonds, and the movie Blood Diamonds, that's very much a part of the history. And it can be other things, copper, oil, whatever it might be. And during the Cold War, there was the West would support one government. Russia and China would support rebels or a different government, and there was that power play all the time. And it was very much a part of the history of the newly independent countries in Africa at that time.
I was just going to go back to talking about where Liberia is now. I did volunteer work there in 2008 and then went back in 2010. And the difference between those 2 years is amazing. There's so many more roads that are paved. There's banks going up in the city. Education is getting better. And so President Sirleaf is doing a good job. They're having a re-election or election year this year happening next month. So I'm a little anxious, but I hear from my friends still there that it's going well so far, and they're hoping that it's very peaceful.
Are there any other audience members that have any experiences in Liberia that they'd like to share with us?
Well, I have the microphone.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Unfortunately, I don't have any direct experience of Liberia, but I wanted to say a couple of things about this documentary.
Go ahead.
The most important for me is that unlike many other documentaries I've seen made by U.S. filmmakers, this movie allows the activists in Liberia to speak for themselves. And you see a grassroots movement for peace led by women. And these same actors narrate, they are the voice of the film. I think this is a breath of fresh air in terms of the typical approach that U.S. filmmakers have, or even U.S. Journalists have when they are looking at other parts of the world. So I really very much commend the approach of the filmmakers. The other thing is that I feel it's a very important pointer to how peace or, say, fundamental social change can come about when people actually decide that they are fed up and organize from within, not something being imposed. And I think many times in Africa, you find that the influences from outside tend to overwhelm the efforts of the people. So it kind of skews the discourse, and at the very end, even the outcome of undertakings like the peace talks that happened between the warring factions in Liberia. So I think for these two reasons, I really very much appreciate
this film. Thanks.
Thank you.
Right now, I'm reading a book for my monthly project this year, and or this month, and it's called The Freedom Writer's Diary, and it's just joining together all of these journal entries from these kids who are living in the neighborhoods with, like, these gangs and having to live around drug dealers and molest and things like that, and just putting out their story, and it's just really insightful. And Freedom Writer's Diary, and it has the 150 teens and their teacher, Miss Erin Grewell. It's just very, it's a really, really good book. From California. It reminded me of the movie. Yeah. Because it just, it really shows you how you can make a difference even if you're just one student or just one person.
That's funny because when you said Freedom Writers, having been going to college in the early 60s, I immediately thought of those people in Mississippi and you're talking about
people in L.A. Oh, I'm sorry. When you mentioned the Freedom Writer's Diary, I was in college in the early 1960s and immediately thought of people in Mississippi. Well, I was going in California.
No.
There's Freedom Writers in California now. A lot has changed, but stayed the same in 50 years.
And now I was just in another city this past weekend, and there is a PBS documentary that was airing about the Freedom Writers, about specifically the Freedom Writers that you were talking about. And I'm not sure if we've run it yet. If we haven't run it yet, we will be airing that also on WILO television.
Hi. I got a couple of things. First, I wanted to answer the gentleman's question. Well, kind of give the gentleman insight here about weapons and how they're proliferated around Africa. And it's just, it's guns, war is big business. It makes money, a lot of money, and it's cheap to buy AK-47s and grenades and things like that. And they have resources to spend on guns, and governments and businessmen will continue to do that as long as it's being used. So it's going to continue for as long as the need is there for it. I also wanted to agree with the gentleman up there about the fact that it's always another country stepping in to come in and save another country, a third world country, countries in Africa, from self-destruction. It's never from the people within. And it's the professor who made a statement about how Africa is forgotten, South America is forgotten, and other third world countries. It's not necessarily that they're forgotten. I mean, they are forgotten. But we have to remember that there are people there who are there living in the country who have not taken the taken their own initiative to jump up and say, you know what, we've had enough of this. Look at apartheid. It was after years and years when they finally said, you know what, enough is enough. The civil rights movement here in the 60s and 70s, slavery, Tunisia, Egypt recently, and Morocco. I mean, it's just an epidemic. If you look at South Africa, what's the country? Swaziland. Swaziland is the last standing monarchy in Africa. In Swaziland, 3 months ago, during the whole Tunisia riots and inspired uprisings, they had 10,000 young people rise up and say, we're tired of having a monarchy. We're tired of the king living extravagantly and people being living in poverty while they celebrate. So it takes the people within to end this destruction. It's not going to end with anyone. It doesn't matter if the U.S. steps in or Europe steps in or whoever. If the people of Africa within those countries aren't ready for change, aren't ready to get up and say, you know what, we're tired of this, it's going to keep going.
My name is Tom Anderson, and I like my friend Tom Moore, was terrified by this, and I was trying to figure out why did the filmmakers make it so terrifying? I mean, once you get to chaos, multitudes of additional chaos does it make it worse? I was having trouble understanding why the layers of chaos up on top of chaos was there. And I think I figured it out. Even amongst the chaos of killing and thirst and hunger and rape, the power of nonviolence came through, of not taking up arms and adding additional violence to try to make it calm down, but the power of nonviolence. And I guess this is one more major kind of instance where it happened and it was effective, and why we can't learn from that, I guess I need some suggestions as to why it is we can't learn from that. Thank you.
Hi. Just to add with the last speaker said, I think we should not overlook the faith perspective that has come through with this. And part of that was the forgiveness that took place. She talked about forgiving these boys who had been taken in. And we think of South Africa, where the whole country came with restorative justice. And this seems almost beyond belief that a whole country can deal with this. But I really think that we have to remember that that was part of this story anyway, and that's part of what continues, because the president there is also a person from that background.
I forgot to introduce myself. My name is William Cifuentes, and I actually work at McKinley Health Center, and I was just teaching at Parkland for sport. But what I was going to say is this. You know, this movement of the women in Liberia is something really vital for the change in Africa. I was just thinking about that. And what worries me about women in Africa is that in Liberia, there was a terrible confrontation. There was a war, rape, pillage, the whole works. But there are other countries in Africa that are under presidents who have been in power for 25 years plus. And when you have a fairly peaceful country where nothing major is happening, but there is always this thirst for change, that's where the real difficulty is, because it's hard to start a movement like this because there is no clear enemy and disaster. There is no doom happening. But there has to be a way to use this movement of these women and spread it throughout West Africa where it's really needed. Because it's very oppressive to be in some of those countries where television is tele-government all the time. There are not even commercials. You know, it's just tele-government. You know, and then the tentacles of these leaders spread down to the last child in the smallest, most minute, faraway village in the country. And I have seen this in action because I have been there on the ground. And I was with a camera crew, and I was the photographer. And I had to take pictures of a lot of things, and I got into the nitty-gritty of what it is to feel that. So this movement is fantastic, and it needs to be spread in Africa.
I'd like to make a comment. The one thing that was very important is they didn't mix with politics. They were dealing with basic human rights. And so they focused on peace, which a lot of times you can, I want money or I want education, I want this, and that will divide what people think is a priority. But when they said, we just want peace, everyone could get on board with what peace would do. And so they went at the root of the problem and not so much at the leaves and figuring out, oh, let's attack the president or let's attack this. The issue is that there's war, there's violence, there's killing, and if we can get peace, then whatever else we need can get worked out and can do better. And so it was the common denominator that they were able to all work together and be able to rise up, because it was very simple, but it was basic. It was something that they didn't have, but it gives hope to the country. you know, if you're a mother. And I think another thing that's important is although the women can be disrespected and raped, there's still a lot of respect for the mother in African cultures. And so that consistency, as you can see, even towards the end when they said, you know, they were convincing the young men, drop your guns, they had to listen to them to an extent. Why didn't they just come and murder them all on the side of the road when they were meeting every day? Because there was still this ingrained respect for the mothers of your country. So even being an older woman makes a difference, you know, and rising up and taking care and still having that nurturing, but still being very firm in who you are and the way you want to raise your children.
Yeah, I think that this movie plants some seeds for us to be aware of what's going on in our country even now, especially as we approach this week of 9/11 and you hear the controversy. You have Christians and Muslim women working together, and it seems to me that I see more anxiety and perhaps hatred in our country fostering that can be problematic for us down the way. So maybe we don't need to wait till it gets so bad. Maybe we need to start hearing some of the words of wisdom from these women who have had to really put their lives on the line. And maybe we can do some things in our country to prevent some of the things that could be on our horizon if we don't read the tea leaves that are right in front of us now.
I've just been struck wondering to myself what this conversation that we're having would be like if it took place in Philo as opposed to here. I mean, what a wonderful resource we have in this community because of the diversity, you know, that we, you just have an event like this and look what comes out. And it's so impressive. I'm a retired teacher educator, and another kind of perspective that I have, I really identified with the early comment about the U.S. being so insular and or so self-absorbed, you know, that we just don't, aren't aware of the rest of the world or even those that are simply not as advantaged as ourselves. And I'm wondering what the role of elementary and secondary schooling, you know, and of libraries and the media as they interact with those younger people. It seems to me that we have a way today of making really vivid some of these issues that relate to injustice that should be able to really capture and motivate young people. And yet we don't see a whole lot of that. One of the philosophies of education that I was exposed to here when I was a student was called social reconstructionism. And it basically was arguing that social studies and even literature and the humanities needed to do a whole lot more to really look at social issues and problems that are out there in the world and figure out how to make them a part of the curriculum. And I think that we really need to explore that more.
I do agree with that. As a sociology major, I didn't really, my experience with education, I cannot remember a specific point in time in elementary school or middle school that really allowed for that global experience, except for maybe, I don't know, February, Black History Month, or, and even that was at a limited basis. And it was, some of it was even rehearsed, you know. So I think that you make a very valid point. I think the other aspect is that my experiences coming from Africa and being immersed into an American system is that understanding now my world is I'm trying to learn everything over again. I'm depending on parents, you would think that, you know, are certainly knowledgeable, but they're also having to learn everything over again. And I think that with those two dynamics for me growing up, made it challenging because now you're going against language barriers, you're going through economic barriers, you're going through so many layers of barriers just to settle and to begin a new life, and let alone make friends with someone that may have never seen someone as dark as me, have never seen or heard someone who speaks a different language other than English. And so I certainly agree with you so much on that. I will say, though, that I was fortunate that the school that I went to was very welcoming of, I guess you could say, me being an outsider. So I learned quickly how to make friends. I learned how to get a global perspective very quickly growing up. But like you alluded to earlier, not a lot of young people know that unless, again, you're exposed to that. So going back to my college years, it wasn't until my major in sociology that we actually looked at problems or issues that affected mass groups of people and really dived into practical principles or practical methods of how do you attack poverty? How do you attack educational issues? How do you attack racism? How do you attack whatever the issue was, whether it's government, politics, what have you? So, and I'm even reminded now of how vital the role of parents are. In the film, you hear Leme, her name, presenting to the president and saying to Madam Pro Tem over the Senate, saying, as a mother, you have to understand, my child is going to ask me tomorrow, Mom, what was your role in this? So we can sit here and dialogue about different methods and different ideas and concepts, which is great and wonderful and plants wonderful seeds. However, when we go home, what are we teaching our children at home? Because it's in the home that's when a lot of the foundations are solidified. It's in the home where a lot of principles are established. It's in the home where those global perspectives are introduced. You know, whether it's me taking my nephew to a museum, whether it's me taking him to, I don't have children, so my nephew gets to have it all. But, you know, I've taken my nephew to rallies that I used to go to during college because I want to expose him. You know, the world is much bigger than, you know, he's seven now, but it's much bigger than this little community, if you will. You know, so I really would impress upon the parents or aunties and uncles and grandparents to really take that role that you play in any child's life and be free to motivate them, to expose them to the world and experiences that you see that they may not have. So,
and to add to that, it's very important. One of the major things that I learned or that I picked out from this particular documentary was the fact that it didn't stop when the peace agreements were signed. They continued on. And that commitment to see it through, and then even after the big rise or even after there might be a huge triumph, a lot of people were like, great, let's go home. And they said, no, we have to see it through until there's, you know, some good progress. And then they said, and we will come back if we start to see this slip. And I think that commitment to things, even someone mentioned earlier about the earthquake and the hurricanes, and, you know, we heard about it for about 48 hours. And afterwards, no one bothered to ask about it. No one bothered to read about it. No one saw the aftermath, you know. And so in this, in a lot of our press and, I guess, journalism in the U.S. tends to be very momentary, you know, and it's what's hot today that's not going to be hot tomorrow and getting the next news story. But there's not a lot of follow through. You know, you're not going to see the blogs have ended. You know, all these stories have kind of passed away. But picking whatever cause it is that we're involved in or that we're committed to and be committed beyond just the initial propaganda that the media gives us for the first day or week. And, you know, and continuing to follow it through till you can see change. And I think that's a legacy that you can pass on to your kids because they're seeing you committed for the long haul. They're seeing you involved. And so then that's what builds that up in them. They can catch hold to that and continue it even after you're not able to do so.
I got to say that I think you'd be surprised at Philo. I think that's an unjustified dig. This is my neighborhood right here. I mean, I live two blocks from here, so I appreciate diversity a lot. But also as a former educator, I taught preschool kids with handicaps, and a message that I carry with me forever is that you don't build from weakness, you build from strength. So it doesn't pay, and you don't make change. You know, I believe strongly that you make change by coming across with the message that I'm going to respect you, and I'm going to like you, and I'm going to accept you, whether or not you change. But here is a solution. Here is a possible better procedure. Okay, and I don't think the U.S., the United States, can get hit both ways. You know, we don't give enough, but yet we're at fault for a whole bunch of stuff. So I think that the idea is to promote change, and change comes from strength, not from itemizing weaknesses and coming down on that. That's just a preschool teacher's perspective, not from Fisher.
What are some of the other ways that those of us that have just seen this film can take advantage of some of the things that we've learned from watching this film, or better ourselves to maybe know more about things like this? Who's got that? Very good.
Hi. I'm a youth group advisor for the Sinai Temple in Champaign here. And one of the projects we're working on, and hopefully in conjunction with the Muslims and Mennonite group here in town, is working on homelessness, and that's just starting to come together. So somebody mentioned Muslim communities coming together, hopefully with Christians and Jews. So that's something that we're looking forward to, so watch out for that. I can offer that.
Okay.
Hi. Unfortunately, I had a prior engagement, so I couldn't come right away. I was very interested in this topic, more so because actually my former roommate from my graduate school days is now the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to Liberia. Mm-hmm. So, and we've remained good friends. So throughout the years, we've talked about some of these issues and talking about cultural shock when this is in 1976, and she came from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I came from Western Illinois. I was the first white friend she really had, and she was my first African-American. So I haven't seen Linda, though. We talked by Skype since her swearing in as an ambassador, which we got to go to. But, she's lived in Africa several years, and also her husband, who's with the State Department. So I've learned a lot about the role of women and the changing of Africa, over the years. She's talked about, even as a woman diplomat, how difficult it is, even like she's bringing in state representatives from the U.S. to the country, that she will be ignored perhaps by, people who own restaurants or where she has to make arrangements because, she's a woman. And she's seen this. I mean, she's told me stories of the violence of Chuck Taylor. And also, she happened to be in Rwanda when the rebels took control. In fact, she was in the compound next to the president, and they were trying to help her over the wall to safety. But, I mean, she has horrific stories to tell, but I think the role of these women is so remarkable. And I think with the role of the new president, I mean, she's a very strong individual if she's able to form coalitions. I went to Rent Entertainment a few times to see what films they have on Liberia. I did order one, and they got it in. That was about a year ago. And he seemed very willing to order additional ones. But I am interested in finding people who might be doing research in Liberia because I'm interested in traveling and getting over there to see her.
And before I forget, this will be on WILL television on Tuesday, the 18th of October at 9 p.m.
Hi. I just wanted to say a few things about my thoughts on the film and thoughts that come in my mind as I listen to some of the discussion. First of all, the film was very informative in the sense that I was not aware of the role that women had played in the struggle for a more liberated Liberia. And so that was very, very educational in that way. I did pay attention back in 2003 to what was going on in Liberia, but that part of the story was not there. So that was, I really applaud the filmmakers for that. The other thing is that, and I might throw a little bit of a monkey wrench in some of the things that were said, but there's a way in which I think forgiveness is a little bit more cracked up than I think we may give it more credit. What I found really interesting about the women was that in many ways they did what they had to do, and that doesn't lessen their bravery, but it speaks to the capacity for human beings to put aside their fear when you have absolutely nothing else. And as long as you think you have something, you cannot maybe really put away that fear. And in many ways, in the United States, we're kind of going through that thing right now with, you know, a sort of diminishing democracy. And we are supposed to be the most free people in the world, and yet we seem to be very, very docile. Okay, that's one thing. The other thing is that I find it interesting that this was a struggle in which women played a very significant role, and then also they were able to elect a woman for president. This was very, very lovely. And I remember when Johnson, Sirleaf Johnson, came to Chicago. I went to see her twice, and it was very, a very extraordinary experience. I think it's interesting that she does have her background with the World Bank. I know she's done some very interesting work, but she's also done something that scares me a little bit, and that's that she's really argued for the... she's argued for Liberia to be a host of AFRICOM, the American Pentagon military command in Africa, and that scares me. That scares me a little bit about her. But another thing is that I think we should be really careful that. You know, South Africa, I know the woman talked about, you know, forgiveness in South Africa and how it transformed the society, etc. But there are many people in South Africa right now who have not, after 15, 16 years, have not really experienced the new nation. So, I think we have to be a little bit... and interrogate the whole idea of forgiveness a little bit more.
There was the gentleman in the... Oh, there's a gentleman in the blue sweatshirt. He had his hand up.
Just had some thoughts. You asked what can we learn from this question or from this this film or something? What can we do? One thing that really stuck out to me was dialogue when the women got together. across from the fish market. They were talking. They said they got to know each other. That seems really important. But apart from the film, it seems here, at least for me personally, in American society, the norm is to ignore these things. And I don't really... It's difficult for me to care about any of this. Living as we do, I guess, or as I do. And I'm aware of that, and it bothers me. And I'm not exactly sure what my role is, but I feel like maybe it starts locally and seeing what I can do, and definitely dialogue and learning. But I'd be interested in others' thoughts on that, I guess.
Well, you did come out and join this audience tonight, so that's a step.
Absolutely. And again, I would also, while you're passing the mic, encourage you to think of it as it doesn't have to, your role doesn't have to be something so big and so massive. You know, the step that you took was coming here. The next step could be making connections with people and finding out what it is that you have a passion to help. Irene here talked about basic human rights. That's what this whole film really focused on, that basic human right of peace. So it's not about, you know, how many degrees you have and what background I came from and so forth, but we're all fighting for the same cause. So even within Champaign, we should be able to come together against hunger, because there are people who are hungry on a daily basis. We should be able to come together on homelessness, as you had talked about. You know, we should be able to come together, whatever we can do as a community, starting with those basic human rights, you know, being able to live somewhere, have shelter, food, clothing, all those things, peace of mind, you know. Those should be some, those are the triggers, if I could say triggers, but those are the things that our internal clock, if you will, should be able to say, wait a minute, if I don't have this, somebody else certainly doesn't have it. And if it doesn't bother you, then you can begin to ask yourself the question, well, what is important to me? You know, and self, do some self-reflection there. But certainly I'm quite sure that we can get you connected to different organizations and just to explore what it is that you find passionate and certainly willing to help with. So,
I just came here actually out of personal interest, just kind of wanting to see a documentary about something I didn't know much about. But the more I listened to our conversation, the more I realized that it has so much to do with my work. I'm working with an organization called Illinois Balanced and Restorative Justice. And restorative justice is something that a woman over here mentioned. And it's a philosophy that can be as specific or as international and global as you want. And it just has so much to do with education and communities and human relationships, and also with the idea of forgiveness, which I think a lot of people can think of as something very simple and simplistic, as just forgiving someone for harm they've caused and erasing it. But the philosophy of restorative justice is about bringing victims, offenders, and communities together to really reflect on harm that has been caused and responsibility and accountability, and taking it beyond the idea of forgiveness and talking about how people can repair their relationships and even begin to try to make up for harm that's occurred. So if anyone has any interest in this, you know, around Illinois or globally, I encourage them to look up restorative justice and the philosophy and to learn more about that, because I think it's a very powerful movement.
Hi, everybody. I'm Titi from Liberia. hi. I just wanted to say I was very young, so I don't remember anything that happened so far. But it's my mom, and she's been through a lot with me. I was very young when the war took place. So I just wanted to let you guys know that she was there the whole time. It was hard to get food, water to eat and stuff. So, but I'm happy I'm here today to watch this video, because watching it made me very sad and my heart beat real fast because I was young, but I know what was going on. So that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
I think documentaries like this, it serves a purpose. You look at the 24-hour news cycle. All we see is the latest trend in the news. We see the latest thing in the Gulf or in the Middle East or wherever the current conflict is at. And then after that 24-hour news cycle, it's gone. So we never think about it again. Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Irene, things like this, they just happen and it's gone. And we don't think twice about it at all. We go about our normal day. We have a cappuccino. We go to work, we talk to our friends, go to a movie, and that's the way we live. It's a reflection of society, not just American society, but the world. We just don't, our propensity to accept violence and atrocities, it's grown and grown and grown, and it just has not changed. It takes a large event like 9/11, or a large event like Hurricane Katrina, or a large event, disaster, for us to come together and say, you know what? Maybe we should care about these people because they're the lowest people on the totem pole. You know, maybe we should care about things that are going on outside of our normal stratosphere. And it doesn't take much. I mean, you don't have to do become a large organizer or a fundraiser. You can start by talking to your friends about, hey, listen, you know, maybe we can do something with this organization locally or do something here or there. So I think these documentaries, they do serve a purpose. I mean, it connects us to the human aspect of what's really going on in Liberia or what's going on in Egypt or what's going on in other parts of the world. I do think, though, that we need to... It's documentaries like this and then the actions that happen afterwards. So we're all here. We all know about what happened in Liberia. We've seen this. Now we can go back and talk to someone else and say, you know what, I saw this documentary. It made me think about doing something. So maybe we can sow a seed in someone and say, you know what, I can try and do something, substance that will change, maybe not 1,000 lives, but one life here or one life there.
Something very simple that, you know, or, you know, to start would be, you said October 18th, they're showing it again?
Yes.
So telling some of your friends about it and saying you really should watch this. Or maybe hosting a little discussion in your own house, inviting some people over to see it. Now that you've seen it, you've partaken in the discussion. You know, that's just something very small that you can do to open up people's minds, because they would never know if they don't see it.
I just wanted to go a little bit farther than you as a panelist did about trying for us all to try to stay more informed about what's going on in the world. And to mention, I think that we each have a responsibility to do that and to look at what our government and the policies of our government, how they affect people around the world, and to look at that not just from the news that we can get in this country, but to get that news from other countries and see how we're perceived by people around the world and how our actions, and I say our actions because if it's our government, we're part of that, how that is affecting the lives of people all over the world. And if it doesn't seem straight to us, we should be trying to change the government or change the behavior of our government.
I just want to make a last comment here, on my part anyway. Somebody said that we are the freest country in the world. That very statement is part of the insularity of this country. I don't think Canadians are any less free than the United States. And being a foreigner, and I have been having been living in other countries, I resent that statement in the sense that it's a made-up stuff, you know? Freedom is not a U.S. creation. It's an inherent human value. It comes all the way from time immemorial, the Greeks, all these people, you know? And so to make it into like a Bush idea that they attacked us because they hate our freedom, I don't think that's true. It's just part of the ingrained stuff that we're number one, we got the best food in the world, we'll kick butt, nobody can rise up to us because we are it. And that thing about being free, the freest people in the world, it's simply not true.
Okay.
To make it clear that, I mean, I know you weren't attacking me or anything. He made that point. He said, but I hate that statement as well. And so I just want it not to be misunderstood as having said we're the freest in the world. But what I, see, he thought I actually said that. That's why I had to make it clear. What I was saying was that is the problem, is that as that we beat our chests, you know, saying all the time that we are the freest people in the world, and
we're on the same page.
We're definitely on the same page. Yeah.
Well, I don't want to keep us here too much longer, and I appreciate everyone for sticking around and making this discussion a discussion. I'd like to thank our panelists. I'd like to thank. Also our support, our translator, and our audio technician. And if you haven't filled out the questionnaire, please do that. The film, again, will be broadcast on WILL on Tuesday, October 18th at 9 p.m. Please recommend it to anybody that you think should see it and watch it again yourself. The discussion will be eventually on our website, Will Connect, if you want to listen to this again. The next screening will be October 4th, I believe. The film will be Deaf Jam, and it's about deaf poets and how they are getting into the mainstream with their poetry. And I hope to have a really good audience here for that. And I am trying to find some deaf poets. Hopefully they will be able to do some poetry here at our next community screening. And I would like to thank all of you for coming. And I hope you have a good evening and are spurred on to do something by watching this documentary. Thank you again, everyone.
Thank you both.